Hello and welcome to this podcast. I'm Karen Coleman, a journalist and broadcaster from Ireland, and I've been reporting and following EU and international news for over three decades. And I want to use my insights and contacts to take a deeper dive into European and global issues from an Irish perspective. And I'm going to do that through this series of podcasts. So today, for this first podcast at the start of this new year in 2024, I'm going to concentrate on two things. Firstly, the Belgian presidency of the EU Council, which has just started and will last for the next 6 months. I'll be asking what Belgium will be focusing on for its presidency. What challenges is it likely to face? And how effective will it be? And then secondly, we're going to look at the European Parliament elections, which will take place in early June. Millions of people across the EU will be entitled to vote on who should represent them in the European Parliament. Here in Ireland, we'll be voting to elect 14 MEPs. That's up one from the previous election in 2019. Ireland was allocated an extra seat last year from the surplus seats left over after the British MEPs departed the EU. Overall, people will vote for 720 MEPs. That's an increase of 15 from 2019, the last time the Parliament's elections were held. So there are the topics we'll be looking at. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined from Brussels by EU journalist Georg von Harrick. Georg's been reporting on European stories for many years. He's one of the best informed EU journalists based in Brussels. Hello to you, Georg, and you're very welcome.
Hello, Karen. Good to be here.
Great. Okay, Georg. First of all, let's look at the EU Council and Belgium's presidency of it. It's just taken over. It's going to face a turbulent time. I mean, we know the Russian war in Ukraine shows no sign of waning. The conflict in the Middle East has split opinion about how EU leaders should respond to it. And of course, it has the alarming potential to spill over into a much greater crisis. And then there are other issues like migration, climate change, COVID continues. What do you think will be the main challenges for the Belgian presidency over the next 6 months?
Well, as you just outlined there, it's quite a list. The interesting thing about Belgium's presidency, so 6 months for each member state, this is Belgium's time, is that it falls in the run-up to the European elections. The European elections, as you mentioned in your introduction, coming up in June. That means that any legislation that the current European Commission and the European Parliament and the member states want to get through before those elections need to happen well in advance of those elections. And that means they fall in the time of the Belgian presidency. That means there's a great number of pieces of legislation that are on the table that need finishing off, and there's a real rush to get those through. So some of the topics you mentioned, for example, migration, you mentioned Ukraine, these are huge and complex bits of legislation. When it comes to Ukraine, it's all got very much tied up in the EU's budget. The idea from the European Union is to supply Ukraine with 50 billion euros over the next 4 years. That's money not for military, that's something separate. This is money to keep Ukraine going. As we know, back in December, the last time EU leaders met, 26 of them agreed to get that money going ahead, but one, Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, blocked it. That means that now during the Belgian presidency, there's a rush to try and get that over the line to ensure that simple everyday tasks in Ukraine, like paying civil servants, can take place before the cash runs out. That's one of the key issues ahead, but there are many in this presidency.
And just sticking with that, Georg, there is an additional complication, which is that, and this is where things can get very confusing for people, the president of the European Council, so the person who oversees its agenda, ensures all the meetings will take place, etc., etc. He's Charles Michel. He's a former Belgian prime minister. He has decided to run for the European Parliament elections. And that would mean he would, if he got elected, he'd be finishing his position much earlier in July rather than in November. But it's what he's doing in the run-up to those elections in June. He'll have to go out and canvass. And there is now some suggestion that if Charles Michel cannot do his job as president of the European Council, then Hungary, which is due to be the next country that takes over the actual presidency of the EU Council, may end up having to do the job. And that would mean its Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, may start chairing meetings. Is that right?
That could be the situation, but obviously the other 26 member states besides Hungary are keen that that doesn't happen. And in actual fact, well, several things. Firstly, Charles Michel, he's standing for election in European elections. As we know, those are taking place in June. He says he can carry on doing the day job of president of the European Council in the meanwhile, and he'll be able to double job until the point where he's elected. And he stands a very good chance of being elected. He's the first person on the list in his party. His party traditionally gets around 3 MEPs. Then in June, leaders from across Europe are anyway supposed to meet to decide how to divvy up the top jobs, the president of the European Council, the president of the European Commission, the role eventually of the president of the European Parliament and some other jobs. So Charles Michel's logic is that anyway, those posts should be divvied up and that person should have been chosen ready to start in July rather than November, which is when his term would normally have ended. So it puts pressure on the leaders to really get sorted, but it's not impossible. The extra motivation for them being sorted is, as you say, that the tradition is if there isn't a president of the European Council in place, the leader of the rotating presidency takes over. And as you rightly say, after Belgium, the next rotating presidency is Hungary. And that's something many European leaders want to avoid. And that's why it looks like the ducks will be put in a row ready for July, which from the European Parliament's point of view is seen as quite a good thing because these negotiations can normally drag on for many months. But instead, the EU leadership could well be in place by the summer, which means kind of the legislative process can kind of start to get going maybe a bit sooner than it would otherwise. That's the theory. We'll see how it works out.
And of course, the point about Hungary and Viktor Orbán being that he's been very much against or causing trouble in terms of enabling that 40 billion to go to Ukraine. He's been a vocal opponent of that, hasn't he, Georg?
So the trouble with Viktor Orbán is severalfold. On Ukraine, it's the 50 billion euros that's due to be sent to Ukraine that he's blocking. But there are also a number of other problems that the EU has with Hungary, namely rule of law concerns about the independence of the judiciary, similar concerns of a number of Eastern European member states, but Hungary really at the fore. So there are a number of reasons why they don't want to see Viktor Orbán in the chair.
Let's move on to the European Parliament elections, Georg. You and I have covered them on many occasions now. 2019 was the last time, so 5 years ago, because they're held every 5 years. They're going to be again, I would say, very interesting. There's a lot of speculation, concerns about maybe more extreme elements taking over or gaining more power in the European Parliament. Now, this was a concern in 2019 and it didn't really manifest itself. But how likely do you think is it this time round that we are going to see a lot more, we'll say, MEPs coming from far-right parties or far-right sections within the EU or indeed extreme left as well?
So looking back firstly to 2019, we did see at that point an increase of the extremes, the far left and the far right. And for the first time, the far right were able to form a grouping within the European Parliament. And at the time, there was a lot of shock about that. But things bedded down and the legislative process carried on and MEPs across the House here found a way of making things work. The hope is from the center, that the same will happen again, that there may be more far right or far left MEPs present, but that there'll be a big enough center ground that the legislative process can continue. The risk that that doesn't happen is that that there are more extremes, and that the extremes are able to disrupt legislation, is more real this time than ever because of the number of EU member states where you look at the polls and there are worries which perhaps weren't there before or were less before. So we have a number of countries across Europe, even member states like Germany, where the Alternative for Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, expected to do very well. However, there are other member states like Spain, which has just re-elected, albeit with a coalition needed, a left-wing government. So it may not be the picture that all European countries have an extremely large far-right contingent. However, it does look that, like, when you count all the MEPs that are coming back here after those June elections, there will be more than there are now, and that could make legislation more problematic for the next five-year term.
But as you say, too, or allude to the fact that politics being politics, no matter how extreme the parties may be that some of those MEPs come from, they still have to do the job, and sometimes it means compromising on issues that they never thought they would do. But let's just look at the Parliament itself, Georg. Again, an institution you know very well, I know very well from all the years going back and forth from Ireland to Strasbourg and indeed to Brussels as well. You're based in Brussels, and of course you go to Strasbourg regularly, so you know this institution very well as well. The Parliament at the moment has 705 MEPs. It has seven groups, of which the largest are the EPP, the Group of the European People's Party, Fine Gael, Irish Party being a member of that. And then the other big one is the S&D, Group of the Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats. And then you go down the list. A lot of times people ask me here in Ireland, and I'm sure they ask you all the time as well, what use is the Parliament? What powers does it have? Does it really do any good, or is it anything else than just a talking shop? What do you think about that?
I think there is now out-of-date view, perhaps, of the European Parliament. Before the Lisbon Treaty, and we're now going back to 2009, the European Parliament had very little powers. It had a say, and it made its position felt, but it didn't have much of a legislative voice. What's happened in the last now 15 years is that has really changed. Most legislation is decided by what's called co-decision. That means it has to be agreed both by governments, the 27 governments, and by the European Parliament. So that gives the European Parliament really quite a strong say in legislation and in kind of moving legislation in the way it would like to see. And you do often see legislation that's proposed by the European Commission that tends to be perhaps from a more right, a centre-right perspective, moving, shifting around as it starts the process through the European Parliament. A classic example of that would be environmental legislation, where the European Parliament takes a much more pro view, even across the centre ground, even on the centre right, than in the Council, than in the Member States representatives. And that means that the end legislation is not what it would have been before Lisbon. It means that you have a mixed picture which reflects the view just not just of the 27 governments, but also of the MEPs elected across Europe.
And just in terms of issues, and issues on the doorstep, as they say, when MEPs are canvassing now, they'll, as I said, there are 14 seats for Ireland. There are many, many issues people will be concerned about. But if you do sort of local polls here, they would suggest housing obviously is a big issue here in Ireland, and the lack of it for many people, particularly young people or those on low income, and then health issues as well. But these are not, as they say, in the competencies necessarily of the overall EU institutions. How are the MEPs going to get around the fact that the issues that matter for people locally may not be issues that they necessarily have any power to control once they get back, or if they get elected to the European Parliament?
Well, I think, Karen, you know, our reporting that we've both done from Brussels and Strasbourg over the years has actually shown the opposite of just how relevant European law is for people's lives. And it really ought to be the job of MEPs and those that are good to do this, of explaining to citizens why legislation is relevant. So, for example, the housing issue in Ireland has sometimes been connected to the migration, the pressures on migration. Migration is an area where the EU has competence. In areas of health, the EU doesn't have direct competence on things like the health service in Ireland. However, when it came to things like the pandemic, the EU very much had a leading role in the rollout of vaccines and buying enough vaccines for all European countries and ensuring that they were distributed to Ireland as well. So I think for MEPs on the doorstep, they need to be making that connection of why what they do here is relevant and important. And I think it is in many ways. Of course, it's also about international affairs. It's about Ukraine, as we've talked about, the position of the EU in the Middle East. But it comes down also to in a whole range of issues. Environmental issues would be another example. The pollution in Dublin, or funding for the tram network, or whatever it is. There are a whole number of ways where Europe is very much involved, the EU is very much involved, and MEPs really should be able to explain on the doorstep how and why that is, and what their opinion is of that legislation that's coming through, and what they're doing to represent their citizens here in Brussels.
And you mention a very, very compelling point, which is in the news very often: migration and how to handle it. It's only up until recently that we've had this issue now as a very challenging one: how to house migrants, refugees, asylum seekers coming to Ireland. That's potentially only going to increase. But the EU is taking a tougher line on this, Georg, isn't it? In terms of now a law that was reached, agreement reached last year on what to do with migrants. I mean, how much of a change are we likely to see over the coming years within the EU in terms of dealing with refugees and asylum seekers?
Well, that is a very important question, and one we won't know the answer to until that legislation starts to come into force. So the Asylum and Migration and Asylum Pact, as it's called in EU terms, is a whole raft of legislation. It's actually not yet completely finished, and that will be one of the priorities for the Belgian presidency to finish it off, because it's only agreed in principle, and that we still need to see the final votes by the European Parliament and agreement of the 27 member states. In theory, the idea of this legislation is to check people when they're coming into the EU at its borders and assign whether they have a right to enter the European Union and seek asylum, and ask member states if they will take a distribution of those asylum seekers. Whether that works in reality, a lot of people are very sceptical. For example, will those countries that really feel the pressure, like Italy and Greece, actually check every migrant and either turn them back or register them? Or will they quietly allow some through, knowing that they're heading not ultimately for Italy or Greece, but heading on to Germany, through to France, perhaps even to Ireland? Those are some of the questions which are being asked about whether this migration and asylum pact is going to work. However, most people agree that it looks to be an improvement to what is there now, which is the so-called Dublin system, where migrants are supposed to stay in the first and register in the first member state where they land, and then that's it. Those states are supposed to look after them. This new system is supposed to kind of share that burden, if not by sharing out the migrants themselves, by then member states like Ireland instead sending money to support the looking after of migrants in places like Greece and Italy. So the proof of whether that works, we will not see for quite some years. And we won't know yet whether it's a system that's going to work.
And just before we go, Georg, we know, of course, speaking of the European elections, they will elect 720 new MEPs. Those elections will take place in early June, I think between the 6th and the 9th, Thursday and Sunday in June. But of course, following the election of the MEPs, we are going to have a completely new commissioner set up. So there'll be a new college of commissioners. There are 27 commissioners in. And then, of course, there's the president of the European Commission as well. Tell me about Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission. Now, you know this because you've been following the news in Ireland. She's kind of gone here from hero to zero over her policy, very much at the initial stages on the Middle East. So after those horrendous attacks on settlers, Israelis and others in the Jewish settlements on October the 7th, we know Ursula von der Leyen went out to Israel. She met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, but she didn't seem to be sympathetic or empathetic to the Palestinian cause or talk to the Palestinian Authority. And a lot of people raised eyebrows about that. Here in Ireland, certainly, there has been criticism of her policy. How are others viewing Ursula von der Leyen's reign as Commission President, but in particular within the lens of her operations, shall we say, towards the Middle East crisis?
I think the Middle East crisis and that famous visit has caused quite a lot of damage. As you say, before that, she was more renowned for the role of the vaccines, playing a big role in that, the Green Deal, the idea of regenerating European industry in a greener way, adapting to climate change. Some of these key issues she'd made a point of leading on, even though she came from the centre-right. She appealed really quite across the centre, also to the centre-left, to the Greens, on those kind of issues. She has been very burnt, I think, by the issue in the Middle East, by her visit to the Middle East. She would defend, I think, her position and saying there that she also feels for the Palestinians. And we have had an ever stronger position from the European Commission in the months since, expressing concerns about the Palestinians. But it's in no doubt that it has damaged her. However, we are still expecting her to want to run. She hasn't yet declared her name, but we are expecting her to run for a second term as President of the European Commission. And as if she becomes a lead candidate for the EPP, the centre-right grouping, she will stand a very good chance of being European Commission President again.
Yes, I was just going to ask you that. If she does throw her hat in the ring again, then it's almost a certainty, is it, that this is assuming, though, presumably, Georg, that the EPP, the European People's Party, the grouping, that they will still be the dominant power within European politics, I presume. If they're not, then things will change, won't they?
Well, yes and no. It would certainly make things easier for her if the EPP remained the largest grouping in the European Parliament, and that is quite likely, although they will probably see fewer MEPs because some will go to the right. They are still likely to be the largest grouping. They're a huge block of MEPs, and they're likely to be the largest again. However, there is no hard and fast rule that the president of the European Commission has to come from the largest bloc in the European Parliament. However, in recent years, that has been the tradition, and I think it's likely to be the case. But if the EPP was not to get a majority, her chances of being European Commission President would certainly be weakened, because the distribution of the top jobs, as they call them, the President of the European Council, the President of the European Commission, and so forth, the divvying up, the argument would go that the largest group should get the first job, and that's seen really as the job at the top. I think she stands a very good chance.
Okay, and on another occasion, I want to come back to you to talk to you about more broadly her legacy, her way of operating, her team, all of that. That's for another day. One final question to you, Georg. There's always this issue and concern from those who feel very strongly about parliamentary democracy and participation in it, that people don't care very much about European elections and electing MEPs to the parliament, which can be many, many, many kilometres away from where they live, and they feel so remotely disconnected from it. What's your own gut instinct on this, Georg? Will we see a wishy-washy turnout, or do you think there's strong enough interest and there will be strong enough interest for a significant turnout in June?
It will depend on, it'll be different in each member state. For example, in Belgium, they have national elections on the 9th of June. There will be an election frenzy kind of attitude here. There's compulsory voting for the national elections. There will be, a strong turnout in some member states. In others, there'll be the feeling that it's remote and turnout will be low. I think it will be a mixed bag, as it always is. Some recent elections have seen an uptick in turnout at a national level, for example, in Poland, and we may see a follow through on that in the European elections too. In general, turnout at European elections is on the low side. We wait to see what happens on the day.
Okay, Georg van Harrick joining us from Brussels. As always, a great pleasure to have you join us and share your fabulous views. Thanks a million, Georg. Hope to see you soon again.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
And that was Brussels-based journalist Georg van Harrick. Well, it's been fantastic to have you along for this podcast. I hope you will join us for our other podcast that will be coming along over the next few weeks. Until then, have a very nice day.